So this work actually is a collaboration of a fairly large number of people that have been sort of joining us as we've been going along. There's Louise Bray, Renee Cote, Alan McDonald, and Steve Gerben, and I, and also H.T.T. Stuff, Carsten Tim, who was at Indiana, has recently gone to Germany, I forget precisely where, Juanjo Palacios, and I guess I'll say a little bit about some work that Ramin Abolfas did when he was at Indiana. Okay, so here's the outline of my talk. I'm going to start out by just saying a few general things about skirmions in the quantum Hall system and why we like to think about quantum Hall systems for certain filling fractions as spontaneous ferromagnets. And then I want to rather quickly review some of the ways we think about these skirmions from a microscopic model using the Hartree-Fock approximation, and use some of the ideas that you get from describing these things to tell you how one can describe what happens when you have many skirmions in a quantum Hall system, and in particular what happens if they crystallize. We'll see that these crystals have some rather unusual ordering associated with them, particularly unusual spin ordering. This is going to lead to some interesting effects in the collective mode spectrum, and we'll show you how what we found for that. And I want to use these ideas about collective modes to tell you about the phase diagram of the skirmion. I'll say a little bit about different structures that you can get, as well as what happens if you include quantum fluctuations. And if there's time, I want to talk about some more recent work on thermal melting of the system. And then I'll conclude with a summary. Okay, so if you're going to talk about ferromagnetism in a quantum Hall system, I think it's always important to start with a slide something like this. That discusses the relevant energy scales of the system. If you're just getting started in this field of quantum Hall effect, it may seem a little silly to think about ferromagnetism in the quantum Hall system, because after all, it does take place in a strong magnetic field. And if you don't think about things too carefully, you might say it's not very very surprising that spins may end up being polarized because you do have Zeeman coupling. But that's really not the right way to think about the problem. And the reason for that is that the Zeeman splitting is actually really one of the smallest energy scales in the problem. If you compare this to the size of both the Coulomb interaction and typically for real experiments with the cyclotron energy, the Zeeman coupling can be easily 50 or even 100 times smaller than these two other energy scales. And so in some sense, the Zeeman coupling is more like a small perturbation than what is responsible for polarizing the electrons. In fact, you can, in certain situations, just turn off the Zeeman coupling. In principle, you could do this with some kind of pressure on a sample, and numerically one can do this just in an exact diagonalization calculation, so if we not include a Zeeman coupling, then you'll find, for example, near filling factor 1, that the ground state is polarized. So spin polarization in the quantum Hall system, near certain filling fractions at least, is really due to the electron-electron interactions. It's a spontaneous effect. It's not something that's being introduced by the Zeeman coupling. So if we can think of the quantum Hall system at least near some of these fractions, and actually most of what I want to say is really about filling factor 1, where we know how to do some controlled approximations, then it's probably appropriate to describe the system, if you want just a low-energy long-wavelength theory, using the nonlinear sigma model. And I think in the context of spins, it was Deng Hai Li and Charles Kane who really first pointed this out. And then some of the consequences of this were really pushed on very hard by Shivaji Sundi and his co-workers. And one of the things that comes out of these ideas is that this system should have skirmion excitations. It's a sort of standard excitation that you get in the nonlinear sigma model. Okay, so for those here who don't know, let me just quickly say what a skirmion is. And I don't know if Eduardo is in the audience, but every time I flash this this slide, I'm a little embarrassed because I've basically copied this out of this book and I still haven't figured out how to draw a nice picture of a skirmion on my own. But the basic idea is, let's imagine that we've got a spin-polarized ground state where all our spins in the ground state are pointing upwards. If we want to create some kind of excitation, you can imagine pulling a spin downward near the origin. And the idea, or the important physics of the nonlinear sigma model, is that you don't want spins varying too rapidly in space, or you'll pay a large spin gradient energy. And so the spin wants to, if it's pointing in the wrong direction near the origin, as you go out to infinity back to the ground state, you would like it to rotate, let's say, radially outwards in a relatively continuous fashion to keep the energy low. And so if I imagine rotating radially outward in any direction, you can kind of see that if you go to some intermediate distance from the origin, that there's going to be an in-plane component of the spin, and if you go in a path that wraps around the center, you can see that that in-plane component has to go around by 2 pi. And that's kind of one of the things that makes skirmions interesting, because it tells you that there's a non-trivial topology to the skirmion, that there's a winding number associated with it. And the way you describe this winding number is by looking at basically looking at the spin density and seeing what different spins are actually present, what different spin directions are present in this spin texture. And so you can do this by constructing a mapping from the plane where the electrons live to a sphere that represents the different possible directions that the spin might be pointing on. And so in this green region, for example, this would map to a region on the sphere showing the different spin directions that are represented in here. And so now you can imagine if we make this green region grow to infinity, just by looking at this picture, you can see that you will cover the sphere for this particular skirmion exactly once. And that basically describes the winding number. The area, the relative area of the sphere that's covered is kind of a winding number. And since it's covered exactly once, it basically can be thought of as an integer, or it really is one. So mathematically, the way you describe this is in terms of this Pontryagin index, which really basically measures the number of times you wrap around the sphere. And for skirmions in general, this winding number has to be integral. Okay. All right, so what's special about the quantum Hall skirmions? What's different about them than skirmions in, say, regular lattice ferromagnets or anti-ferromagnets, is that quantum Hall skirmions carry charge. That's very different than the lattice models, where these are neutral excitations. What you find is that if you want to construct these spin textures, but you don't want to occupy higher lambda levels in order to do it, you find that it's really not possible to construct the spin texture, at least if it's varying slowly in space, without introducing charge densities as well. So this, in this way, you're forced to introduce a charge into the system if you want to introduce the spin texture, and it turns out, I should go back here, it turns out that that charge density is really just proportional to what's inside this integrand, what's inside this integrand of the Pontryagin index. So because of that, when we integrate up the net charge of the skirmion, you discover that the charge is quantized. And so it works out the charge of these skirmion excitations is proportional to the Pontryagin index. The proportionality constant is basically just the filling factor of the quantum Hall state that you're working near. So then that tells us that there's a possibility of something very special about quantum Hall skirmions, and that is that if we dope our system away from the magic filling factors, that we could actually inject the skirmions into the ground state of the system. And that, if we can really do it, would be a nice thing, because in other systems where you have skirmions, these are usually excited states. Here we could get them into the ground state, provided that it's really true that the skirmions are the lowest energy charge particles of the system. And so that's one question that you need to answer or convince yourself of, that at least in some situations, they are the lowest energy charge particles. And that's actually one of the important, really one of the important contributions that Shivaji Sandhi made, was to show that at least in one limit, where the Zeeman coupling is vanishingly small, that it's indeed true that these quasi-particles are lower in energy than just spin-polarized quasi-particles. Okay. All right, so how do we look at this, the properties of skirmions in a more quantitative fashion? We'd like to use a microscopic model to analyze them if we're going to look at quantitative issues. The obvious thing to start with is the Hartree-Fock approximation. I just want to say a few words about this for the single skirmion case. So the idea of a Hartree-Fock approximation is to write down a single Slater determinant that in one way or another actually describes the spin texture of the system. And it turns out that the way you can do this is by taking the single particle states to be linear combinations of spin up and spin down states in the lowest Landau level, whose angular momenta differ by one unit and whose spins are oriented oppositely from one another. And it's not very hard to convince yourself that if you look at the spin density of just one of these states, that it indeed has a spin that's tipped outward and rotates around in just the right way to get you this winding in the spin density. So you basically treat these U's and V's as variational parameters, and as in any variational problem, you just look for the minimum energy with respect to the parameters. One thing that's interesting to notice about this is that there's kind of a free parameter here. Basically, the relative phase of the U's and V's is free. Basically, we can choose it to be anything we like. And you'll find that as long as theta is not a function of M, you won't change the energy of the system. That means that the skirmion, even the single skirmion, is in fact a broken symmetry state. And this angle theta has a nice simple interpretation actually for the skirmion. It turns out that it's basically just the angle made by the in-plane component of the spin, the xy component of the spin, with respect to some reference direction. I've chosen that reference direction here just to be aligned from the center of the skirmion radially outward. So if I change this theta, I'm rotating all my spins in the xy plane, and that doesn't cost me any energy. If I do a global rotation xy in the xy plane, the energy of the state will not change. And that symmetry is going to turn out to be very important when we go to the skirm crystal situation. Another thing here to notice is that the quantum numbers, as in a lot of Hartree-Fock approximations, the quantum numbers here are kind of messed up. We don't really have our spin and our orbital angular momenta properly quantized individually, although depending on whether it's a skirmion or anti-skirmion, the sum or difference of these might be properly quantized. And the other thing here that I'd like you to remember is that you can characterize the size of a skirmion by the number of spins that are pointing in the minority direction. And that's very easy to compute for these Hartree-Fock states. It's basically just the sum, the weights of these spin-down states summed together. Okay, so this is an important quantity. Remember, it's basically the size of a skirmion. Okay, let me just flash one picture. So, of course, one of the first things you're going to do if you're doing Hartree-Fock is compute the energy. And you find, indeed, that it's true that the skirmions are lower in energy than spin polarized quasi particles. So that's good news. It really does say that if I start injecting these particles into the system, even in experimentally relevant situations, which I think in these units is down here, that the quasi particles will go in with a spin texture. The bad news is that the difference in energy between spin-polarized quasi-particles and skirmions in experimentally relevant parameter range is actually pretty small. It's only about a 10% difference. So if you were looking to understand in detail the activation energy, for example, of a nu equals 1 quantum Hall state, you would be hard-pressed to really tell the difference if you just looked at activation energies between spin-polarized states and skirmion states. Although if you're clever about tilting your sample, you can show it, and that's something Jim Eisenstein and his coworkers had done. Okay. Well, at that time there weren't experiments such as Jim's around, and we were thinking about how you would see the skirmions. How would you know you have skirmions in this system? One thing that we suggested was that perhaps you could look at the spin polarization of an electron gas to look for a degrading of the polarization as you inject quasi particles into the system. But drawing on Uri Sivan's restaurant analogy, I guess I was sort of more used to just cooking things with microwaves, and I didn't know very much about what goes on in experimental kitchens, and didn't think it was really very feasible, even if we suggested it, that someone was going to measure the spin polarization of a 2D electron gas. But I had never visited Sean Barrett's restaurant, and apparently it was on his menu. And in fact, it was going on in his lab that as we were doing these calculations, he was in fact measuring exactly the quantity we were interested in. And he indeed found that as you double away from, let's say, nu equals 1, that you indeed get this very strong degrading of the polarization. And you can see that the amount of degrading seems to be that you're getting about 3 to 4 spins flipped into the minority direction per quasi-particle that's injected into the system. So that looked very good. And in fact, it looked almost better than it should be, because if you really look at this quantitatively, at least from the Hartree-Fock calculations, you really find that the number of flipped spins is in the experimentally relevant parameter range. It's really somewhere between 2 and 5. It's sort of right in there. It seems that the Hartree-Fock calculation is doing much better than it deserves to. And what it seems to be saying a posteriori is that quantum fluctuations in the system are somehow very small. It wasn't immediately obvious to us why that should be the case, but if this is getting things, it's after all, Hartree-Fock is mean field theory. If it's getting things right, quantum fluctuations must be small. And actually, one of the things we did, and this is in part work that Juanjo Palacios and Ramin Abolfoff worked on, is to look at different ways of computing the spin textures and the size of skirmions and compare the various methods. So in particular, if you look at an exact diagonalization, finite size calculations extrapolated to large systems and compare this to the Hartree-Fock results, that's basically the dotted and dashed lines here, you can see, now I'm showing you the z component of the spin for particular size skirmions, you can see they really do match quite well. And so that really does suggest that for one reason or another that perhaps we don't understand very well, the quantum fluctuations in the system do seem to be small, at least if you're working around the Hartree-Fock mean field state. The other thing that you can compare to is the results of the field theory that that Shivaji and his coworkers worked out and numerically compute the spin polarizations associated with the energy function they wrote down. That's the solid line over here. And not surprisingly, for smaller skirmions, it doesn't do terribly well, but as you get to large skirmions, it does better and better. That's kind of to be expected because it's nonlinear sigma model, plus its variance is really basically a long wavelength theory, and you really need to have things varying slowly in space if you want it to do well. Okay, so much for single skirmions. What happens when we have many of them? What happens when we start to dope in a lot of quasi-particles? Well, let's start out by thinking about what happens if we don't have spin texture associated with each quasi-particle. And I want to think about the most idealized situation, so let's ignore the existence of disorder in our samples. Then you would expect the quasi-particles to line up into some lattice, and as long as these quasi-particles aren't too close together, presumably they'll form a triangular lattice, because for point charges, this has lowest Madelung energy. It's lowest Madelung energy for Bravais lattice in 2D. And so now we can ask, what happens when we allow these quasi-particles to carry the spin texture? And basically, those spin textures start to bump up against one another as we put more and more quasi-particles in. And the way to do this, the basic method we used was one that René Coté and Alan McDonald worked out quite some time ago for computing Hartree-Fock states of spatially periodic systems. Okay. So let me just take you into... Well, as I say, I only know how to use a microwave, so let me show you a little bit of my microwave, just one transparency of it. So how do you do? What's different about Hartree-Fock? What's different about Hartree-Fock for skirmion states than for other kinds of states? Well, the standard Hartree-Fock prescription is you start out with your many-body Hamiltonian with some density operators, and you replace this by a single-body Hamiltonian where you've changed, basically, traded this in for an average of one of these density operators, and then just have a single density operator, Hamiltonian. And this W here includes both the direct and the exchange interactions. And you need to come up with some guess for what this order parameter is going to be. If you guess badly, you may come to some very high energy solution, or you may come to no solution at all. You may have trouble getting your program to converge. So you need to guess intelligently about what this what this density operator, what this order parameter is going to look like. For states that don't have spin texture, well, you usually look at states that have these sorts of order parameters. And what's different about the skirmion state, and kind of is motivated by what we know about the Hartree-Fock state in the single skirmion case, is that we know we need to mix spin up and spin down states. And that's really what becomes new about the skirmion state. So we want to include states with this kind of order parameter. And then if you think about it a little more, you realize that the symmetry that you really want, if you want to get around any skirmion on your lattice to get this spin to wind around, what you want to have is that if you look at any particular cube, the density operator, any particular cube vector, that if you rotate that cube vector by some angle, then there should be a corresponding phase in which the average of the density operator changes. Okay, so that's basically the new ingredient. That's the recipe that you use to do this, to get skirmion states in a crystal. Okay, so the first thing to try is just, after all, the triangular state. After all, that seems to be the right thing to do. When you don't have a spin texture, this is an example of what you get out of the Hartree-Fock calculation, so that's all well and fine. But you can measure, or in the calculation, you can look at the spin polarization of that state, And you run into a problem very quickly. The spin polarization associated with the triangular state is this dotted line here. What you find is that you don't go very far away from the magic filling factor before the skirmions start to collapse. The skirmions are bumping into each other. Their spin textures, well, let me show you what's happening to their spin textures. Spin textures have a problem. And the problem is that if I've got a Brevet lattice, a triangular lattice, that's a Brevet lattice, so each of the skirmions is the same. If you look at what's happening along the nearest neighbor bond, you can see that the spin is actually forced to rotate by 2 pi as I go along the nearest neighbor bond. That means there's going to be a large spin gradient energy. And as I go to higher densities, if I make this bond too short, that spin gradient is going to be pretty big, and that's going to cause the skirmions to collapse. And what you can see here is that it's collapsing too fast, at least compared to experiment. The skirmions are not surviving out in this triangular lattice nearly as far as what happens in the experiment. Well, what that seems to suggest is that we need to find some way of rotating the in-plane spins for nearest neighbors relative to one another to try to do something about this 2 pi rotation. But that's going to be very hard to do for the triangular lattice because it's frustrated. You're not going to be able to make the spins along all 3 of these nearest neighbor bonds really agree with one another. And so that suggests one should look at a lattice that's not frustrated. And so immediately one thinks about the square lattice. That's the simplest example of such a lattice. In the square lattice, we can now take a 2-point basis and really make the skirmions, let's say at a center here and at a corner here, they're really different. They've actually got the relative angle of the in-plane spins relative to a radial vector. Here it's pointing outward. Sometimes Louise likes to say this is attacking. These are pointing inward. He likes to call this defending. Okay, so. But the nice thing about having these postures rotated by pi with respect to one another is we can have a nice continuous spin along the nearest neighbor bond, and this has a lot less spin gradient energy associated with it. And then you couple that with the fact that the Madelung energy of a triangular lattice and a square lattice that are at the same density is actually very, very close. This little bit, it's actually not that small as it turns out, but this bit of gradient energy that you gain very easily makes up for the slightly higher Madelung energy. And you find the square lattice over a broad range of parameters is really lower in energy. The other thing here to notice about the square lattice is that it's got this kind of look of a kind of anti-ferromagnet. We have the in-plane XY spin kind of with an angle, let's say, of 0 with respect to a radial vector. Here it's got an angle of pi. Okay, and that's going to be very important because that's a broken symmetry that's going to lead to some interesting collective modes. Okay, so we want to have these in-plane spins rotated by pi with respect to one another for nearest neighbors. Okay, so this really worked out very well because if you compute the spin polarization now with a square lattice rather than triangular lattice, you get for different Zeeman couplings, you get these solid and dashed lines here, and you can see the agreement experiment improves dramatically. We really can make these skirmions exist out to much larger filling factors than we had with the triangular lattice. So that made us very happy as well. Okay. Okay. Another thing you can think about, well, I just showed you square and triangular lattices. And in principle, you can think about all kinds of lattice structures and might want to do Hartree-Fock calculations for all of them, although that's very tedious. A simpler way to look at different possible lattice structures is to come up with kind of a simple classical model, and this is something that Karsten Timm has been working on. And so basically what he's done is thought about a classical model that's really appropriate when the skirmions are very far apart. And so one comes up with an energy function for different lattice structures that's the sum of a piece that doesn't depend on the XY spin and a piece that does. Okay, and so for the piece that doesn't, at long distances, the simplest approximation you can use is just that of point particles, so just a simple Madelung energy for this part over here. For the part that does depend on spin, basically we put in a cosine term to try to get the spins to line up appropriately anti-parallel to one another, and then basically use sort of the large distance spin texture that you get out of the field theory for the spin texture itself. And then there's kind of a parameter here, which is a little hard to compute, but it characterizes just how many flip spins there really are in the skirmion. And it tells you something about how strong the spin coupling is between between the skirmions themselves. So we kind of leave this as a parameter that can be adjusted. So it's a lot easier to look at different lattice structures in this approach, and you actually find that the phase diagram is pretty rich. So the parameters here are a little complicated to think about, but roughly speaking, you can think of this axis, again, roughly speaking, as being density, and this axis is kind of proportional to this gxy, or the square of it. So this is something like the size of the skirmions. Maybe you could think of it as the Zeeman coupling. Okay, so it's telling you about how strong the spins of the different skirmions are coupling together. And so now let's say we fix the Zeeman coupling and just vary the density. That means we're doing something like going along here horizontally, and you see that you do go through a triangular state into a square state when you get to higher densities. And one thing here that Carson found that we hadn't anticipated in the Hartree-Fock calculations is that you actually pass through a centered rectangular state. That's something that we should probably go back and look at in the Hartree-Fock approach before you get into the square lattice. There are also at stronger coupling some more interesting states here. There's a honeycomb lattice, and actually the square lattice at stronger couplings turns out to be unstable against forming a rectangular lattice with a continuously varying aspect ratio for its primitive cell. So there's really a whole host of states here. It's something of an open question of how many of these can really be realized for physically relevant parameters, but it certainly suggests that there could be a very rich structural phase diagram.
The
triangular lattice, I'm not sure if he used some kind of spiral state or if it's just a Purvey lattice. Do you know, Steve, if it's... So I think it's a Purvey lattice that they're just bumping there. For the triangular lattice, if it's a Purvey lattice, then it's the ferromagnetically aligned, right? Okay. All right. So anyway, we do have these states that some of which look a lot like anti-ferromagnets, and one of the things that you immediately think about when you have this situation is that there should be some new collective modes in the system, basically corresponding to the spin waves of this effective XY anti-ferromagnet that describes this in-plane degree of freedom of spins. So again, sort of beating this down very hard, you should notice that we can rotate all the spins in the XY plane for the entire system and not change the energy of the state. And the fact that we have this broken global symmetry tells us there'll be a new Goldstone mode. There should be something like a spin wave associated with this broken symmetry. So we looked for this using, again, Hartree-Fock, in this case, time-dependent Hartree-Fock. I'll just say a few words about that. In time-dependent Hartree-Fock, you focus on response functions of the system. And we looked at both density-density response and various spin response functions. And the nice thing about this time-dependent Hartree-Fock is if you think about what you're doing in terms of diagrams, this turns out to be basically lattice plus bubble. So you actually have vertex corrections in your calculation, and that's usually something very hard to do. As people have done this, many people have done much more of this than I have in this audience. In general, it's very hard to do, but it turns out that the nice analytic properties of the lowest Landau level really let you treat these ladders basically exactly. In fact, it's no harder to do the ladders than it is to do the bubble. So it turns out to be much easier in this situation than in most cases. So you can do a pretty good job at looking at these response functions. Of course, the poles tell you where the collective modes are. And let me show you an example of the kind of result you get. Okay, so this is for a particular choice of Zeeman coupling, filling factor 1.1, so a certain density of skirmions. And this is showing the poles that appear in the response functions. Some of these are easy to understand. Down here, there's a mode that disperses roughly as k to the 3 halves. It's basically the standard phonon mode for charged particles in a magnetic field. You also have a mode appearing in the spin response function down here that's exactly up at the Zeeman coupling, just as you expect. It should be at the bare Zeeman coupling due to Larmor's theorem. There's another mode appearing in the spin response function down here. But here's the new one that's really interesting. That's gapless. This is basically the new spin wave. And it's appearing. I need to say something very carefully here. These modes here appear, the way it's labeled, it would seem that these modes are appearing as poles in different response functions. But that's not quite right. the modes appear as poles for specific response functions only very close to k equals 0. But as you move away from k equals 0, you in fact find that basically all these modes appear in all the response functions. And this is really the physics of this spin-charge coupling, that if you try to move charge around in the lowest lambda level, you're probably going to move spins around as well. And you really can't have these things totally separated out. Okay, so all the modes seem to be appearing in all the different response functions. And in particular, even, for example, this spin response function has what looks like the phonon mode appearing way out of the corner of the Brillouin end zone. So you can really see that these modes are basically all there. Okay. So that's having these gapless modes appear in the spin response functions is an interesting point. It's a very nice thing, actually, because of something else that's on Sean Barrett's menu that we learned about. And that's, if you look at the nuclear magnetic relaxation rate, 1 over T1, as a function of filling factor, one of the things that Sean found in his experiments is that this relaxation rate tends to shoot up as you move away from nu equals 1. Now, you have to, in nuclear magnetic relaxation, you need to think about if the nuclear spins are flipping from their minority to their majority direction, then that spin, as well as the energy of that spin flip, has to go into something else. And you'd like to think that it's going into the electronic degrees of freedom. But if it's going to couple to the electronic degrees of freedom, there has to be very low excitations that can couple to the spins. And it's not so obvious that that could happen if you didn't have this funny spin texture, because at least in a crystal of quasi-particles with no spin texture, the low-energy mode is a phonon. It's a charge mode. It's not a spin mode. And it would be you'd be hard-pressed to see how the electrons can absorb these tiny amounts of energy in the absence of the spin texture. But then, if we do remember the spin texture and think about this new collective mode, and also just the fact that the gapless modes start to appear in the spin response function because of the spin-charge coupling, specifically down here, it's not so hard to understand anymore why we could get an enhancement of this relaxation rate, because now we really have very low energy modes, and it's actually appearing in exactly the right response function, the one that you need to absorb the spin flips from the nuclei. Okay, so that allows us to understand how we can get this enhancement of this relaxation rate as we move away from nu equals 1. The skirmions are being introduced, and perhaps, it's one explanation anyway, perhaps these gapless modes are appearing in the spin response function. Okay, now I want to spend the last, how long do I have? About 10 minutes. Okay, hopefully that's enough. I want to say some words about the phase diagram of the Skirm lattice. I've said something about the structural phase diagram. I could say a little more about what we learned from Hartree-Fock, but let me not use my time that way. Let's move on to thinking about quantum fluctuations. And so this is sort of an interesting problem, and if Matt Fisher is here, I don't know if he probably knows this. He actually contributed to this problem long before this problem existed, actually, because we were able to borrow some work that he did. He suggested a solution. So let's go back to thinking about the energy of, a single skirmion as a function of its size. You could, for example, if you wanted to look at this as a function of its size, you could actually map out, as a function of k, using Hartree-Fock, how this energy varies. And actually, this is something we've done. It's really not that hard to do within the Hartree-Fock approach. And what you find is this energy as a function of its size for a given Zeeman coupling will have a minimum that basically determines the size of the skirmion at given Zeeman coupling. But there's a problem with this. Again, always a problem with Hartree-Fock, that you don't get the quantum numbers quite right. And maybe I haven't drawn this quite as well as I should. These really maybe should be dots instead of levels. The k's here really should be quantized. They're quantum numbers. It's the number of flipped spins. It's related to S sub z minus a constant, basically. So they should be quantized. And so you can ask yourself, how can I quantize if I started with a Hartree-Fock state? How could I get the right quantum numbers? How could I quantize this? Well, the most straightforward way to do this, it turns out, is to take these skirmion states for different angles theta, for different postures of the xy spin, and average them with a phase factor over all possible phases, all possible directions. And you can show, in fact, if you do this for a hard core model interaction, you can actually show that when you do this procedure, if you start with Hartree-Fock state over here, if you do this procedure, you'll actually get the exact answer for the state of the skirmion with the right spin, with a particular spin number k. So the fact that you have this relationship between k and theta tells you that this is, that these are conjugate variables, that if we quantize the system, that that they shouldn't commute. And so that gives us the beginning of a phenomenological model for treating quantum fluctuations. So here's the idea. We'll treat this energy for the single skirmion basically in a quadratic approximation. So we'll just treat this down here as if it's a parabola, and so have a contribution to our energy with some curvature that the u here we treat as parameter. So that's one piece of the physics. We know the skirmions want to pick out a particular size for a particular set of of parameters. And then the other piece is we want to couple the skirmions together. We know they have this kind of anti-ferromagnetic alignment, so we'll put in a cosine term that's trying to make the skirmions anti-ferromagnetic, and then again put in a phenomenological parameter that tells you how strong that spin coupling is. And the beauty of this is that we can look at this model and, for example, compute the spin wave spectrum if we imagine that we're in a state of well-defined thetas, and then compare that to the spin wave spectrum that we found in the Hartree-Fock, and thereby get a measure of what this J is. And similarly, from a curve like this, if we like, we could figure out what the U is here. And so from the Hartree-Fock calculations, we actually get a quantitative idea of what the parameters are going into this model. So we have a really good idea of where we're sitting in parameter space for the system. No, it's only spin modes. Well, I mean, we're assuming that at long wavelengths these things separate out, right? At least we saw that in the response functions, that was the case. I mean, there'll certainly be fluctuations from the phonons as well. Okay. All right, so, well, here's where Matt Fisher helped us out 9 years ago. This model is not new. This model actually is, I think if you change the names of what you mean by these variables, is the...
You've got actually 12 minutes.
Oh.
Including your extended time and extension.
Okay. Okay. So I'll slow down. So this model, this is the Bose-Hubbard model. And really we don't have to change what we've written down, we just have to sort of change what the names of the variables mean. The theta, which was a kind of angle for this XY model, is now basically the wave function for a boson on a tight binding site. And the K, which was, remember that was the number of flipped spins, can be thought of as the number of bosons located on a given site. Then this J, which was the coupling between the spins, now should be thought of as basically a hopping parameter for the bosons from site to site. And the U is the Hubbard part of the model. It's the on-site repulsion, the fact that you don't want to have an arbitrarily not large number of bosons on a given site. And finally, this K0 ends up basically playing the role of a chemical potential. Remember, K0 kind of told us what the size of the skirmion would like to be, and this is telling us, in this case, how many bosons we'd like to have on a given site. So in this model, there are two states that you find. For very large coupling, not surprisingly, the kind of state you find is a phase coherent state, which you can think of as a superconducting state. And the main experimental or the main difference between this state and the other is that there is a gap in the spectrum. Because this has a long-range broken symmetry, you're going to get a Goldstone mode, a gapless mode in the spectrum. But as you go down in coupling, in most situations, you find that eventually this U is going to become more important than the J. The bosons don't want to hop and hop and hop and have fluctuations in the number of bosons on a given site. They would like to try to fix them at some preferred number. And when that happens, the fluctuations in the hopping bosons quiets down, and now you actually lose the phase coherence, the coherence in the theta angle, and the system goes, in this language, into a Mott insulator. One of the important differences is that there's a gap in the excitation spectrum for the Mott insulator, whereas here we have this gapless mode. So now, taking this phase diagram, we can ask ourselves, okay, where do we sit in this picture with respect to K0 and J and U? We know what these parameters are for our model. So, for example, we could fix the density of skirmions fix the density of skirmions and look at trajectory for the physical parameters as a function of, let's say, Zeeman coupling, and see when we are in the superconducting state. This is basically the spin-ordered state for the skirm lattice. And when we're in this mod-insulating state, where the spins are fluctuating on all the sites and they don't really lock together. Okay. And so you can do this for various different basically values of densities of skirmions, different filling factors, and then map out the phase diagram. And this is what you get from such a calculation. So the shaded areas here are where we have this locking of the spin variables and have the gapless mode. Gapless mode is stable against the quantum fluctuations. The open area is where we find that we have the analog of the mod insulator state, where the skirmions would rather try to stay near their individual preferred sizes and don't really lock together because of those quantum fluctuations. The solid line here, incidentally, within the Hartree-Fock is the structural phase transition between the square lattice and the triangular lattice. And as I said, there probably should be another line here for centered rectangular, which we haven't really investigated. Okay. Say that again? Sorry? It has broken translational symmetry. So, I'm sorry, so what's...
So you think that that's a reasonable state, that you've got no XY order, but still a broken translational symmetry.
So you're going to have a phonon mode, is that what you're saying?
Of course.
So maybe I shouldn't use the word gapless mode. Of course, you'll still have a phonon mode. But there's this extra mode, right, when you have the...
An alternative feature is that once you lose the spin order, you also lose the translational symmetry.
Once you lose it, no, but I don't think you necessarily do.
Yeah.
I don't think you necessarily do. Why you should still have a square lattice if you lose the... I think that's right. If you're saying... Yeah. I think that depends basically on the correlation length, right, for the spin ordering. I mean, if there's a... Even if it's not infinite, if it's long enough, you probably could still have a square lattice. But it's certainly true. If that becomes small enough, it's going to be unstable against triangular lattice. I agree. Okay. I want to turn off quantum fluctuations now and think about how stable the system is against finite temperatures. And this is a mildly amusing problem, I guess. And I'll say why. In many ways, if we want to think about melting and spin disordering in the system, the thing that will come into your mind, of course, is the Koslitz-Dallas transition. And in the system, because we have both this kind of anti-ferromagnetic ordering as well as a crystal, we're going to have two types of defects that can combine. We can have vortices in the anti-ferromagnet. We can also have dislocations in the crystal. And that's—I don't want to think about the transition from hexatic to isotropic liquid. But let's just pretend hexatic is a liquid, and just think about these two types of defects. What's interesting about this is, so you might think they're just two separate transitions for the system, but that's not exactly right. And the reason is that you really can't just have dislocations kind of in isolation of the vortices in the system. And the reason is that, let's imagine in the square lattice, and I want to restrict this discussion to the square lattice, let's imagine that we have a dislocation and introduce an extra line of skirmions into our system. And so now these spins are basically specifying this effective XY, the direction of the XY posture. If I introduce this extra line, well, I can arrange things so that this extra line will have the spins anti-ferromagnetic lines along one bond, but you could see if I look at the bond above, I'm in trouble. Those spins are going to be ferromagnetically aligned. And if I just try to leave the spin texture like this, then I'm going to have a whole line of unsatisfied bonds, and that means that the energy of this dislocation would actually increase linearly with the system size instead of logarithmically. And, of course, the system will not want to do that. The way it gets around this is to introduce basically a half vortex around the dislocation core. And so by rotating everything just by basically half a turn, we're able to do a much better job of lining up the spins anti-parallel to one another. But the energy you pay in doing that is logarithmic because you have a vortex there. It's logarithmic in the system size, but that's much better than linear. So, of course, for large enough systems, the dislocations are always going to do this. So that means we've always got a half vortex stuck in the core of a around the core of a dislocation. And that tells us that we can have some locking of the vortex unbinding transitions and the dislocation unbinding transition. So at first this begins to look like actually a pretty messy problem, because in some sense you have five different types of defects here. We've got the dislocations which can point in either in the square lattice in either the x or y direction, but then they can have vortices attached to them which either have plus vorticity or negative vorticity. So that's four types of particles. And then you have just the vortices by themselves that are not attached to dislocations. So in all, five types of particles plus their antiparticles. So you might need to think about the coupling among all these. But it's actually not that bad, because underlying all these defects is really only two charges that are relevant. Basically, the charge that's associated with the vorticity of the vortices, and then basically the effective charge of the defects that tells you how the energies of how these defects interact with one another. The model we use for our Hamiltonian, I should say, is a little bit simplified. We just have logarithmic interactions with whatever appropriate coupling for these different charges is coming in. Logarithmic interactions between the defects. For the dislocations, there also should be an angular term, but that's just an added complication that we didn't really want to deal with, so we've kind of left that out. So you can kind of follow basically this prescription that Mike Koslitz worked out many years ago for figuring out what happens as you go to larger and larger length scales, and how the various fugacities and coupling constants scale. And it's the equations you get are not very different than the original Koslitz-Thallus scaling equations. They look like this. For our purposes, what I want to say, it's really these coefficients here that are relevant, because this tells us what the minimum couplings are going to be before the system becomes unstable against pairs of vortices unbinding or pairs of dislocations unbinding. And so this JV is the coupling between the vortices, between the vortex charges, and this is the coupling between the bare dislocation charges, but you can see that you have coupling between the vortices basically added onto it, because each dislocation has a vortex attached, or half a vortex attached. So we know from this sort of scaling equations, that means that as the renormalization flows make these renormalize these couplings and make them small enough, eventually there's a minimum value. If we try to make it smaller than that, these couplings just collapse to zero and the system melts. And the interesting thing here is that you can have basically two types of transitions. We can have two uncoupled transitions, one, let's say, first in which the vortices unlock. When the vortices unlock, this JV will suddenly drop to zero, and we'll get a small discontinuity in the coupling between dislocations. But you still have to eventually maybe turn up the temperature even further before the coupling between dislocations is weak enough to make that the actual crystal melt. But on the other hand, if these things are close enough in the bare coupling parameters, then you might, for example, have the vortices come to its critical value and drop to zero. Then you get this little discontinuity, and that might push the dislocation coupling down as well below its minimum value, and then you'll have locked phase transitions. You'll have the spin and dislocation disordering happening simultaneously. Jung-sun? This is spin and charge order. The spin's disorder here. Now it's just charge ordered, okay, and then it's fully disordered. Okay, so you can have spin and charge order, and you can have charge order but no spin order, but not the other way around. Okay, so that leads to two possible phase diagrams that we might want to think about. And actually, we don't know which of these is really the right one for physically relevant parameters. We can have basically these unlocked transitions occurring over the entire physical parameter range, and basically may possibly go through both transitions in order to really fully disorder the system. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that there might be some parameter range where these things really do lock together, and we have the two phase transition lines join into one. And it would be interesting to know which of these really happens in the real system. And I think Jung-sun actually mentioned that he's doing some simulations on the system, so maybe he'll be able to answer this question for us in several months. Okay, so that's really what I wanted to say. Let me put up my summary here. Okay, so we've seen that we can describe these Skirm lattices and rather the quantum Hall system in terms of spontaneous ferromagnetism, and that tells us these systems actually can support Skirmion excitations. We found that we can describe them using a Hartree Fock approach and get a very nice agreement really with what's found from NMR calculations. When we have lots of Skirmions, they could form a lattice. There's this unusual anti-ferromagnetic correlation in that lattice. It leads to some unusual structures and also to some new collective modes which have important consequences for quantum fluctuations in the system. And finally, we said a little bit about how the system is likely to melt due to thermal fluctuations. So thank you for your attention. You mean how much? So the question is, how much long-range order do we really need to have some contact with the experiment? You mean, for example, like have a gapless mode? Is that right? Well, I mean, the experiments are acting like there are low-energy modes already there, right, in the NMR data, because we're getting this enhanced 1 over T1. Really, the point here, I'm not really sure quantitatively what the answer to the question is. I mean, no. No way. No way.
Maybe I can comment. So there's these 13 experiments. Those are done at temperatures low enough that there might be energy in the lattice if there were no disorders.
Mm-hmm.
The Barrett NMR experiments are definitely.
But these disorders the whole point.
Yeah, yeah. Barrett experiments are definitely done at a temperature above there. So both temperature and disorder will destroy the long-range translation. But it seems likely that you could imagine that this gapless, nicely propagating selective mode just becomes overdamped and diffuses. But the oscillator string, the spectral density is still there.
Right.
So unlike in a bigger crystal where it can come to death.
It's not necessarily true if the charge ordering gets pinned that the spin ordering has to be pinned, right? So you could still have...
The dirt couples only to the charge, which is indirectly connected with the spin. It's not directly
right.
Pinning the spin.
So, my question is actually a continuation of Tim's question.
Mm.
So disorder is neglected in most of your lattice calculations.
Right.
But, I mean, disorder is very relevant, of course.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible, for example, your triangular lattice to be structured at all the deep. In the presence of disorder, it would become like a Skirmion
glass. I think it's very likely that is what would happen. That's right, but the question again is correlation length. I mean, we might have square lattice ordering over some distance,
yeah.
And the question is, how dirty is it? I mean, can we have a few lattice constants of this?
For some model, can you include disorder at least in energetic calculation, or is that...
We could include it. Probably one could include it, for example, in one of these models,
right,
where you have a sort of a classical interaction between point particles.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be hard pressed to do it in the Hartree-Fock calculation. Chung-san.
So probably the result, the experimental data will be much more sensitive than the case of the quantum only thing will be that deal with the increase of the impurity strength, but
I think this is more sensitive. I believe that's right. These states are much more sensitive, right?